This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Farewell, starts by telling you that the film is based on an actual lie. My guest, Lulu Wong, drew on her own experiences to write and direct the film. Wong emigrated with her parents from China to the U.S. when she was six. In 2013, her grandmother in China was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and given 3 months to live. Family members in China decided not to tell her, to shield the grandmother from the anxiety of knowing the end was near. Her parents agreed to withhold the information, but it was a decision that Wong found very upsetting. Here's how it plays out in the film. The parents tell Billy, the character based on Lulu Wong, that they're going to China to see her grandmother and celebrate the good news that Billy's cousin is getting married. Billy is confused by how somber her parents sound while talking about something that's supposed to be celebratory. So the parents confess to her that the real reason for the trip is that her grandmother is dying.
I need to call her.
You can't do that.
I need to go see her.
You can't do that. She doesn't know. The family thinks it's better not to tell her, so you can't say anything.
I don't understand. She doesn't have a lot of time left. She should know, right?
There's nothing they can do. So everyone decided it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have saying, when people get cancer, they die. It's not the cancer that kills them. It's the fear.
Okay, when were you guys gonna tell me this? How could you let me find out like this?
How should I have told you? Oh, your grandma's on the roof?
What about the wedding?
Wedding is an excuse so everyone can go see her. We leave first thing in the morning.
I need to go.
Billy.
I need to go.
Everyone thinks better if you don't. Look at you. You can't hide your emotions. If you go, Nana will find out right away.
In real life, just as in the film, Wong, her parents, uncle, and cousin head to China to see her grandmother, knowing they may never see her again. But they keep up the pretext that it's a visit to celebrate the cousin's wedding. And of course, things get more complicated than expected. While Wong was trying to get this film made, after getting rejected by producers in the U.S. and China, she told the story in the form of a personal essay on This American Life. That broadcast led producers who were interested in her story to reach out and help her make the film. Lulu Wong, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
When your parents told you that you couldn't tell your grandmother that she had stage 4 cancer and probably only had 3 months to live, what was your reaction?
I was shocked. It was a very confusing time because I was still grappling with my grief. And then to be given this other information, it was almost hard to decipher what was the stronger emotion, the grief or the frustration, anger.
The around anger, not being able to say anything.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so there was a part of me that just, you know, my instinct was just to go to her, to call her, to cry with her and to, you know, have this catharsis. But then I'm told I can't do any of that. And so I guess I just didn't know how to feel or what to do.
Did you eventually feel there was any wisdom in not telling her?
Yes. I mean, the lie enabled me to spend time with her. And what I mean is the lie enabled me to make this movie, which enabled me to go back to her city and spend time with her. You know, and not only spend time with her, but she got to come to set. She got to meet my producers. She has recently met my partner. You know, it's been a blessing in so many ways, and yet it's still troubling because ethically, I still don't know that I necessarily agree with that concept.
Wait, so she's still alive because she came to your set. Does she mm-hmm. know that she has what was officially diagnosed as terminal lung cancer? Because, I mean, the movie's about her and about the diagnosis and about you guys not telling her. So she must be in on it now, unless you lied to her about what the movie's about, which maybe you did.
We did, in fact, lie to her about what the movie's about. My grandmother came to the production start party, and she met all of the actors and clearly saw that they were playing, you know, members of our family. And Zhao Shujin, the actress who played my grandmother, actually wanted to meet her, and so she went over there to her house for breakfast, and they spent the morning together. And so, you know, eventually my grandmother came to know that the film is about our family, but I told her that, you know, it was just this sort of immigration story about this family who left and are coming back for a reunion because of a wedding, which, you know, is only a lie by omission. It's a lie, but, you know, I think that it wasn't that difficult to keep up, because even when she visited set, a lot of the scenes that she saw reflected that plot that I told her.
Oh, the joyous celebration part. Yeah. And it's a family coming together. There's going to be a wedding. But, you know, does she read film reviews?
Not really.
Not even of her granddaughter's film? Because that would give it all away.
It would, and I've asked my great aunt. It's hard for me to know, because my grandmother doesn't really leave the house now, and I don't know how much she's on, you know, Baidu is like the Chinese Google, I guess, and I don't know how much she's actually searching, because I don't know that she even knows the title of the film. Mm-hmm. I haven't told her that. And, I can't tell her that, because the Chinese title is actually different than the English title. And the Chinese title is Don't Tell Her.
No, that kind of gives it away.
Yeah. You know, so we have not told her the title. And so my name in Chinese is different than my English name. So I'm not sure that she would think to go and search for it.
I hate to put it this way, but this lie you were so reluctant to tell, you've kind of compounded by making a movie all about the lie and lying to her about the movie.
I know.
Forgive me for laughing.
No, I know. And it's, you know, I started making this movie because it was a way for me to explore all of these complicated feelings that I had and explore these questions that I had about what was the ethical thing to do. And when I started making the film, I told my family about it. I said, you know, is it okay that I'm going to make this film? It might be out in the world. And I don't think any of us thought how big the film would get, you know, the reach that it would have. And in some ways, this is a very Chinese thing, at least for my family. It feels very specific to my parents, which is that they always want to underplay things because they don't want to jinx it. And so when I told them I was, you know, hired by this company, we were going to write the script, and they said, well, you've written scripts before that have not gone anywhere, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. You know, if they're paying you, just write the script, pay your rent, you know, good for you. And then it was the same thing when I, you know, started shooting the film. They said, well, you know, go shoot the film, spend time with your grandmother. She'll be very happy to see you. We'll figure out a way to make sure she doesn't find out. But, you know, who knows where the film is going to ultimately end up. Let's just not worry about it. And then it was Sundance, the same thing. They said, well, it's an American festival. You know, it's still an indie film. So every time I brought this issue up, they just kept punting the problem down the line. And so now we're at a point where, in a way, I don't feel responsible, because I feel like I've given everybody ample preparation for this moment.
Did you also think that by the time the film was finished, your grandmother would probably no longer be alive because of the prognosis?
Yes. I think that's absolutely what everyone was thinking, that, you know, why get ahead of ourselves when we don't know what her health is going to be like? And, you know, let's not preemptively ruin her life by telling her something when we just don't know where she's going to be down the line. Maybe she'll never have to find out. And, yeah, so now here we are. We have Chinese distribution. So the movie's going to be released in China, and we've played at the Shanghai Film Festival, so there's you know, I'm told, because I don't read Chinese and I'm not on the Chinese websites, but I'm told that it's been written about.
So your grandmother fought in the Chinese army when she was 14. Who was she fighting?
She was fighting on the side of the Communist Party against the nationalists. And, you know, at the time, it was really just a way for her to escape an arranged marriage. Her family had arranged for her to be married, and she didn't want to do that. And the army was, you know, crossing through town, and they were recruiting. And so she just picked up a backpack and joined.
So this was during the Chinese Revolution?
Yes.
So your grandmother was 14, so she was basically a child soldier.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she got shot.
I don't think she actually got shot. You know, it's so funny because now I'm mixing fiction and nonfiction.
I'm doing as well.
Yeah. No, the bullet was something that, you know, I put in there for the sake of the movie. She does have a limp. I don't think it's from being shot. That's not to say she didn't get injured, but she really walked the distance from, you know, Miami to Boston is the equivalent of the distance that she had walked, you know, across China.
She went against her family's wishes, defied an arranged marriage, and joined the army instead. That's a heck of a story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what's so amazing about that generation. I'm sure you can, you know, go to China, go to the park, and talk to any elderly person, and they would have an incredible story like that.
Mm-hmm. So your mother was a writer for what I've read was the Chinese equivalent of The New Yorker, that she was a culture critic and editor at the Beijing Literary Gazette. And I always feel for people who move to another country where they don't speak the language when they move there, or they don't speak it that well yet, and they're a writer or a speaker of some sort, and they're deprived of doing what they do to the degree that they do it in their native tongue. Because, you know, and so I'm wondering if you know what that was like for your mother to be deprived of, you know, some of her greatest talent because she didn't have the language skills in English.
It was incredibly difficult. You know, I was very, very young seeing that, but, you know, to be, you know, first of all, she was part of the Cultural Revolution. And so during the Cultural Revolution, she was sent to a factory to work and didn't finish the fifth grade, because that's when her education was interrupted to be sent to do manual labor for the country. And she really, you know, taught herself everything in order to become a writer. She, you know, read everything on her own, and she had to smuggle books back then. And it was a very difficult journey for her, with a fifth grade education, to become the editor of this very culturally lauded, you know, publication. And also back then it was mostly men. So then for her to leave all of that at the age of 35, 36, to come to a country where she was seen as uneducated, as seen as an outsider, and she had to take on an entry-level job. She was treated with a lot of disrespect and, you know, came home just humiliated. It was hard, you know, and I grew up watching that. My father had to do the same thing. He was a diplomat in the Soviet Union. He'd been studying Russian since he was a kid, because he was part of the foreign ministry and was one of the youngest Chinese diplomats to be sent to the Soviet Union. I think he was 16 when he first went to Moscow and spent, you know, 8 years there. And speaks, you know, fluent Russian, later spoke fluent English, but going to America, he delivered pizzas, you know? And he would tell us stories about delivering pizzas to strip clubs, because that's, you know, sometimes the late night shift, that's what you do. So it's, you know, I don't think it's a unique story for an immigrant family, but it was hard.
Why did they come to America?
Oh, gosh. A lot of reasons. Opportunity, you know, thinking there's a better future. But I think, honestly, first and foremost, government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't talk too much about it.
I understand. Yeah.
My family, yeah, family doesn't want me to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think mainly for political reasons.
What's it like for you to hear the president's rhetoric about immigrants, knowing what your family went through to come here and what they gave up to come here, and how skilled and how smart they were when they came here, and they ended up, you know, like your father at first was delivering pizzas to strip clubs and your mother was treated disrespectfully at the work that she was doing as if she was, you know, not smart at all when she was, in fact, you know, a former editor at a important magazine in China.
It's completely infuriating, you know, and it's hard because I try not to make it too political, you know, when I talk about my film. But when I see what's happening, it's hard to avoid the subject as well, right? You know, because I think that the core of being American is what my family went through, you know, and to become an American. Like, they earned the right to be American more than anyone who, you know, feels that they're entitled to being American just because they were here for a few generations and, you know, because of the color of their skin. I don't know. Who does get to claim Americanness? You know, my brother was born in this country. And is he seen as American? So, I mean, it brings up a lot of interesting questions. And we talk about it in my family as well, because there's all of this discussion about, well, there's the legal way to do it, and there's the illegal way to do it, and you have to make that distinction. But I just think that the way that we're treating immigration is completely different now than it was when we came to this country in 1989.
And you became a citizen, right?
Oh, yeah, at a very young age when, you know, because I was under 18, when my parents became citizens, I became a citizen.
So what part of your life disappeared when you came to the U.S.? Because you were 6, I think, when you came here?
Yeah, I was 6 when I came here. And I remember my first day of school, you know, that I was in this classroom, and they have the morning announcements in school, and so the TV was on, and then somebody started speaking, and everybody stood up and put their hand to their chest. And the teacher ran over to me, because she saw that I was confused, and just picked up my hand and put it to my chest. And I have a very distinct memory of that moment, because I didn't understand what it was and what we were saying or any of that. And in China, you know, there's also similar kinds of morning announcements, morning exercises, and morning chants. And I knew those for a little bit, because I didn't go to first grade, but I went to kindergarten. And so, you know, I think, I think more than anything, I lost a sense of belonging, a sense of wholeness. And, you know, from then on, after moving to the States, it's been trying to rediscover that feeling, trying to find that wholeness again.
Your story was told first as a This American Life piece, because you tried to shop your movie idea, the same story basically, but a fictionalized version. You tried to shop that to American producers and Chinese producers, and you kept getting turned down in both countries. Tell us some of the reasons why you were given in both countries about why this movie wouldn't work.
Well, I think in both countries, people felt like the stakes weren't high enough. You know, an 80-year-old Chinese grandmother, what are the stakes? Whether you tell her or you don't tell her, she's 80, you know, and she has cancer. And so I think people just felt like it needed to be broader in both countries. And they were asking me on both sides, you know, well, is it for an American audience or is it for a Chinese audience? And I think American producers, studios that I initially pitched to felt like if it was an American film, it had to look like an American film, you know, and we couldn't have subtitles. And so they wanted to change the casting. They wanted to change the language and possibly even the location. They also didn't understand why Billy wasn't the bride, because that would give her more stakes, you know, if she was the one who had to be forced to marry somebody that she maybe didn't like. And the Chinese producer said that if the film was going to be a Chinese film marketed to a Chinese audience, then the main character could not be Billy because she was too westernized in her
perspective. She's the character based on you.
Yes, Billy is the character based on me, who is an American going back to China, back to her home country, and at odds with her family's decision to tell this lie.
Lulu Wang, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Lulu Wang wrote and directed the new film, The Farewell. Quentin Tarantino's new movie was just released. It's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it's set in and around the film and TV industry in Los Angeles in 1969, the same year the city was jolted by the Charles Manson murders. Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt star as a TV actor and his stunt double, leading a cast that also includes Margot Robbie, Timothy Olyphant, Dakota Fanning, and Al Pacino. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a nearly three-hour buddy comedy anchored by two of the world's biggest stars and set against a sprawling recreation of 1969 Los Angeles. It's also the most personal and resonant film that Quentin Tarantino has made in years. That might be an odd thing to say about a story that tackles the Charles Manson murders and gradually builds in tension before erupting in scenes of astonishing violence. But Tarantino's down-and-dirty B-movie world operates by its own emotional logic, and there's a tenderness and a melancholy to this movie unlike anything he's done since Jackie Brown. Like that great 1997 film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is both a love letter to L.A. and a bittersweet rumination on failure and regret. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Rick Dalton, an actor who once starred in a popular TV western in the 50s and early 60s, but whose career has since stalled. He's like a parallel universe version of Clint Eastwood, who never made it big. He lives in a mansion on Cielo Drive that he may not be able to afford for much longer, and he looks with envy at his next-door neighbors, Roman Polanski, the hottest director in town, and his actress wife, Sharon Tate. Rick leans heavily on Cliff Booth, his loyal stunt double and best friend, played by Brad Pitt. While this is the first time DiCaprio and Pitt have appeared on screen together, their natural rapport suggests they've been doing this forever. Rick drinks and mopes around and bemoans his failure, and Cliff pulls him out of his funk again and again. Cliff is a good guy to have around when things get tough. He even holds his own in a fight on a set with Bruce Lee, played amusingly, but too briefly, by Mike Moe. But Cliff also has a dark side, a violent past that frightens some of Rick's colleagues, like Randy, a stunt coordinator, played by Kurt Russell.
Look, Randy, I'm asking you to help me out, man.
If the answer's no, the answer's no. Not no with excuses.
Hey, man. This ain't a Andy McLaughlin picture, you know? And I can't afford to hire a bunch of guys that smoke cigarettes and sit around talking to each other all day on the chance that I might use them.
I got a 4-man team here, Rick. If I need more than that, I got to get it approved. And, you know, I got to look after my dudes.
Hey, and if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for
me.
Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rick?
Yeah.
I don't dig him. And I don't dig the vibe he brings on a set.
Few directors are as passionately committed to their own movie love as Tarantino. And here he gives us a playfully warped, through-the-looking-glass vision of L.A., spotlighting classic locations like Hollywood's legendary Musso and Frank Grill and the now-closed Van Nuys Drive-In. The fabulous production design is crammed with Golden Age movie memorabilia, some real and some fake. But this is also Tarantino's most relaxed movie in a while, and although it may test your patience with its languid rhythms and low-key hangout vibes, every moment of it pulses with feeling. It's also an unusually sensitive movie about actors and their insecurities. Rick's drunken breakdowns on the set are contrasted with a subplot centered on Sharon Tate, played by a luminous Margot Robbie. There's a beautiful scene when Sharon goes to the theater in Westwood and watches herself in the 1968 spy comedy, The Wrecking Crew, basking in the audience's appreciative laughter. Robbie's performance becomes the movie's soulful center, an unabashed tribute to Tate's spirit and her memory. The real-life Tate and her unborn child were murdered in August 1969 by members of the Manson cult, a tragedy that the movie addresses with an audacity, but also a sensitivity that I wouldn't have thought possible. Tarantino has drawn a lot of criticism over the years for his use of violence, especially against his female characters, and also for his bold rewriting of history in movies like Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained. I'm loath to give away what happens at the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Given the director's track record, it's both what you might expect and also not. It comes to an extraordinarily wistful and moving close that suggests the times may have chastened Tarantino. This is his first picture not released by his longtime distributor, Harvey Weinstein. The famously effusive director has been unusually tight-lipped in promoting the film, an understandable but odd decision for such a clearly personal work. But the movie speaks eloquently enough for itself. It captures a precarious moment between the last gasp of the old Hollywood studio system and the cinematic renaissance of the 1970s that would eventually give rise to the 90s independent film movement. That could make the movie something of an origin story for Tarantino himself, but if so, it's a decidedly moody and reflective one. Tarantino has said that he will direct just one more film after this, but it would be hard to imagine a more fitting swan song than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a fond farewell to the dream factory he loves.
Justin Chang is a film critic at the LA Times. Coming up, we hear from sleep disorder specialist Guy Leschner, author of The Nocturnal Brain. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Dr. Guy Leschner, writes that you can survive longer without food than without sleep. As a sleep disorder specialist, he's seen plenty of patients with insomnia and just about every other kind of nocturnal problem: night terrors, narcolepsy, sleep apnea, sleepwalking, sleep eating, sleep driving, and something called sexsomnia. In his new book, he describes some of his more challenging cases and the growing body of research into sleep and sleep problems. Guy Leschner is a neurologist and head of the Sleep Disorder Center at Guy's Hospital in London. He spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies about his new book, The Nocturnal Brain: Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep.
Dr. Guy Leschner, welcome to Fresh Air. You've got some fascinating cases in this book, but before we get to them, I want to just cover a couple of basics. A lot of us have heard of rapid eye movement sleep, you know, REM sleep, where our eyeballs are darting rapidly. And then there's non-rapid eye movement sleep, non-REM sleep. You want to just explain the differences between these two kinds of sleep?
Well, if one looks at the brain during sleep. We now know that actually sleep is not a static state. It's not a simple binary state whereby we're either awake or asleep. What we now know is that actually there are a number of different brain states that occur while we sleep, and we tend to divide those brain states, those sleep states, into, as you say, REM or rapid eye movement sleep and non-REM sleep. In REM sleep, actually, when we look at the brain, from an electrical point of view, looks to be very, very active. In fact, the brain waves look very much like the brain waves of an awake brain. And it's during this stage of sleep that we associate dreaming to occur, particularly those dreams of a narrative structure, plots evolving overnight. And during that stage of sleep, when the brain is very active, actually, it's probably when we are most separated from our bodies. In fact, although in this stage of sleep, the eyes dart back and forward, pretty much every single muscle in our bodies, apart from the muscles that control our eyes, are completely paralyzed. Whereas in non-REM sleep, when we look at the brain waves, the brain waves are slow, they're large. This is less associated with dreaming, although we do dream of sorts in non-REM sleep. And it seems that these two different types of sleep probably have rather different functions.
Yeah, what are the different functions?
Well, I think the short answer to that is that we don't fully know. We think that REM sleep is particularly important, depending on the stage of life, in the development of consciousness, in learning, in creativity, in emotional processing, whereas non-REM sleep is perhaps the stage of sleep during which those restorative functions that impact the brain and also impact the body occur. So things like cleansing out toxic metabolites from the brain, regulation of the immune system, and a variety of other functions.
Okay, let's talk about some of the disorders that confront you in the clinic. Sleepwalking is one, and you've had some patients with some pretty strange episodes. You want to share a couple of them?
Yeah, so the one that always comes to mind, first of all, is the 70-year-old woman that I saw a few years ago who would be found to be driving up and down the seafront in her local town in the middle of the night. In fact, in earlier life, she had had a motorbike and had been seen riding her motorbike, apparently in her sleep. And even at an earlier stage, she was brought up in Canada, and she would often go into the wilderness with the guides on camp and would wake up her tent mates growling very loudly in the middle of the night. Of course, they thought that they were being attacked by a grizzly bear, and so she was soon sent back home because of the terror that she triggered in all her colleagues. That's one example, but sleepwalking or conditions associated with sleepwalking can really manifest in a number of ways, and these include sleep terrors, where people wake up in the middle of the night absolutely terrified, screaming and shouting, and then go back to sleep, often with very little recall. And then there are some other conditions, things like sexsomnia, which is sexual behavior in sleep. Sometimes these conditions sound very funny, and indeed can be very funny, but on other occasions they can be really life-changing, resulting in major injury or, as one of the cases that I describe in the book, in a criminal conviction.
Right. And you had a patient named Alex who would get up and order pizzas, and then do any of them remember any of this after the fact?
Well, we used to think that people don't really remember anything that occurs in this stage that seems to relate to the fact that the brain in parts is in very deep sleep whilst in other parts is awake. What we have learned over the last few years is that actually quite a lot of people have some sort of limited recall. They don't necessarily remember the details of all the events or indeed the entirety of the event, but sometimes they do experience little snippets. So Alex, who you referred to, would also do things like distribute glasses of water around the house for his sleeping flatmates without any recollection. But those events that were associated with a much stronger emotional content, so natural disasters. On one occasion, he dragged his girlfriend out of bed in the middle of the night because he thought that a tsunami was about to wash them away. And those kinds of events with strong emotional context are often better remembered.
Right. So this category of sleep problem, this is non-REM parasomnia. This is from the sleep where your eyeballs are not darting about.
That's right.
You mentioned that it manifests in sleepwalking, sleep driving, sleep eating, and something you refer to as sexomnia. You want to tell us what that is, what your patients have exhibited?
So sexomnia is really a type of non-REM parasomnia that manifests with sexual behavior. And the range of sexual behavior can be quite broad, but at its extremes, it can result in people trying to pursue full-blown sexual intercourse in sleep. We used to think of sexomnia as being a relatively rare phenomenon, but actually, whenever I do anything like this on the radio or write about it, I'm usually inundated by emails or messages saying, oh, yes, I do that. And actually, in the sleep lab, if you directly ask people about sexomnia, a lot of people will actually report it, but they don't tend to go to their doctor with it because for most people, it's not a particular problem. Where it does get to be a major problem is if it results in unwanted sexual behavior, usually when you're sharing a bed with somebody who is not your regular partner. And as I describe in one of the cases, one of my patients ended up convicted of rape as a result of one of these events.
For a lot of people, these non-REM parasomnia, these conditions can create serious problems. So for people like Jackie, who was driving around in her neighborhood, or Alex, who was ordering pizzas, how do you treat them?
Well, I think the first question is whether or not they want specific treatment. As I talked about in the book with Jackie, actually, the reason why Jackie came to see me is because she was worried about the fact that she was driving up and down her seafront in the middle of the night and thought that she might be a danger to herself and to other people. And it was when she went to her family practitioner that she was told, well, actually, the only way to manage this might be to get her admitted into an inpatient secure psychiatric unit. But actually, she had gone through her life seeing this as very much part and parcel of who she was. And she actually hit upon her own way of trying to manage this, in that she bought herself a time-locked safe where she would deposit her car keys and knew that she could not get her car keys out of the safe until 6 o'clock in the morning, thus treating herself very well. For people who are putting themselves at risk or putting other people at risk, there are a range of things that we can do. The first thing is to try and optimize sleep generally, because in people who are sleep deprived, that in itself can prime the brain for developing these sorts of behaviors. But for more extreme cases, and if that doesn't work, then dealing with anything else that might be disrupting their sleep, looking at their environment, looking to see whether or not they snore, and treating those issues is often a very successful way of dealing with these sorts of problems. In very few cases, when people are really putting themselves at risk, then we will resort to certain types of medication to try and treat these sorts of events.
What kinds of medication?
Well, the sorts of treatments that have been demonstrated to work include drugs like melatonin in certain instances, benzodiazepines like clonazepam, and also a range of antidepressant drugs. Now, all of these drugs have potentially serious short and long-term side effects. So in any individual, the risks and the benefits of treating them with medication need to be weighed up very carefully.
So you manage it behaviorally if you can.
And I think that that's the case for many sleep disorders. If we can avoid medication, then that would be the optimal way of managing these conditions.
You say that we're seeing an epidemic of sleep apnea.
Yeah, so as our girths, as our weights increase, the incidence of obstructive sleep apnea also increases. Sleep apnea is very strongly associated with obesity. In that weight on the throat or on the chest, fat being deposited within the muscles in our throats, can often result in our airway becoming narrower or actually losing structural rigidity more easily. So as we as a population get larger, obstructive sleep apnea gets worse. And the issue is beyond simply that of feeling sleepy because one's had one's sleep disrupted all the way through the night. We are now aware that obstructive sleep apnea has a range of long-term implications on our health in terms of high blood pressure, in terms of risk of cardiovascular disease, risk of stroke, impact on our cognition, so our mental clarity. And there is now an emerging body of evidence to suggest that actually obstructive sleep apnea may be a factor in the development of conditions like dementia.
Wow. Well, we haven't talked about insomnia, which is so common. I mean, I didn't get a very good night's sleep last night. You say insomnia and sleep deprivation are quite different. In what way?
Well, when people have insomnia, they think that they are sleeping very little. And certainly that's the case for some individuals with insomnia. But we know that insomnia is more than just one condition. So some people, for example, will feel that they've had very, very poor quality sleep. But actually, when we monitor their brain waves, their sleep overnight in a sleep lab, we can actually see that they're getting a pretty decent amount of sleep. And so people can sometimes misperceive the amount of sleep that they have. In other individuals, actually, when one is slightly sleep restricted as a result of insomnia, the brain tends to compensate for that by increasing the proportion of a very deep sleep. So the slight difficulty is that people with insomnia have often read lots of stuff about how disruptive, how bad for every aspect of your health sleep deprivation is. But the solution for people who are sleep deprived is much easier. Essentially, you just need to increase the amount of time you spend in bed and the amount of time you sleep. Whereas for people with insomnia, that's much more difficult to achieve. It's not a question of how much of an opportunity they have to sleep. It's the very fact that they can't get off to sleep when they want to that is the issue. Or even if they do fall asleep, it's the fact that they feel that their sleep quality is poor. And so they read all this stuff about how damaging sleep deprivation is. And actually, that increases their anxiety about the fact that they're not getting off to sleep and can result in this vicious cycle. If you're a good sleeper, you tend to associate being in bed with being that place of comfort, that place where you go and you feel cozy and you drift off to sleep and you wake up in the morning feeling wide awake and refreshed. But for people with insomnia, they often associate bed with great difficulty getting off to sleep, with the dread of the night ahead, with the fact that they know that when they wake up in the morning, they will feel horribly unrefreshed and unrested. And so sleep, the environment that we normally would associate with sleep, becomes an instrument of torture for them.
You know, I've always been able to function pretty well on 5 or 6 hours of sleep at night, or at least so I've thought. Am I deluding myself? Am I harming myself?
Well, there are significant genetic influences as to how much sleep we need. So this notion of 7 to 8 hours being the optimal amount is correct when one looks at a population. But for a particular individual, we know that there are people who get on absolutely fine with less than 7 hours or actually need 9 or 10 hours to feel fully refreshed. One of the great difficulties is that we know that there are genetic influences that influence not only our resistance to sleep deprivation in terms of how sleepy we are, but also in terms of the cognitive effects of sleep deprivation. So what I mean by that is that just because you don't necessarily feel sleepy does not imply that the sleep deprivation that you're experiencing is not having any impact on your mental abilities, your performance. And so perhaps the worst situation to be in is to be one of those individuals who doesn't get particularly sleepy when they're sleep deprived, but is very liable to those cognitive effects.
You're a neurologist, and there's a lot of research going on in various aspects of sleep. What are the questions you're most interested in seeing answered in the coming years?
Well, I think the question why we sleep still has to be answered. I mean, in a way, you know, we've moved tremendously far in terms of understanding why we sleep, but there is still an awful lot to be learned. You know, we do this thing for 8 hours a night. You know, we spend far more time sleeping than doing anything else. And to ask the question, why do we eat or why do we drink, it would be laughable. Yet we're still asking the question, why do we sleep? The reality is that sleep probably has, you know, a multitude of different functions. But at the moment, we still don't really know the true answer. There's lots of work still to be done. The other areas that I think are going to be of fundamental importance is understanding the association between sleep and some of the major issues from a public health perspective that we face, in particular conditions like dementia. If we can really truly understand that sleep disruption or sleep disorders can increase our risk of developing dementia, then that provides a huge opportunity, because sleep is one of the potentially major modifiable risk factors for these sorts of conditions.
I'm told there are podcasts that are designed to help you fall. Good idea?
I've occasionally, out of interest, listened to one of these podcasts, which was a man in a sort of deep South accent murmuring gently, telling a very boring story. And the aim of it is to distract you from the process of getting off to sleep. So just providing enough distraction that you're not concentrating on, oh my God, I've got to go to sleep, I'm going to be awake all night, but not providing enough interest to keep you awake at night. I think the key thing is to work out what works for you. And if that works for you, great. If a white noise generator or a pink noise generator works for you, then great. And the same thing is the case for caffeine. You know, there are some people for whom having two shots of espresso before they go to bed will have absolutely no impact on their sleep whatsoever. And if that works for you, then go for it. If you know that caffeine is going to disrupt your sleep, then avoid it from lunchtime onwards, because caffeine can, depending on how much of it you drink, can hang around for a long, long time. It's about understanding your own sleep and working out what works for you.
Well, Guy Leschner, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Guy Leschner is a neurologist who heads the Sleep Disorder Center at Guy's Hospital in London. His new book is called The Nocturnal Brain: Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.